Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is singer-songwriter Adam Brodsky. Brodsky returns June 5th with his first album in over two decades. It's titled American Epitaph, and it features his usually pointed political observations, as well as songs that also display his singular sense of humor. All that, plus an especially moving number. Brodsky, who entered the Guinness Book of World Records in 2003 for fastest tour by a solo performer after playing 50 shows in 50 states over the course of 50 days, recently spoke about how he was inspired to make a new album, his anti-folk past, and why protest songs may be more important now than ever. That's Adam Brodsky on Into Music, coming up now. There is probably no way that you remember this, but we have spoken before. One time was when you were coming through Kirby's on the 50 in 50 tour.
Called Kirby's.
And I wrote this piece about you doing that, and I said, you know, well, Phil Collins with Live Aid played on two continents, but Adam's doing, you know, this, which is much more important.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, is Kirby still around?
Oh yeah.
Excellent. I like to call that the least fabulous gay bar in America.
But yeah, it's still around and owned by people who came out of the music community. So they've kept it in safe hands. The rest of the neighborhood has undergone a lot of transformation, but we always have our fingers crossed for Kirby's.
So. Okay. Excellent. Good. I'm so glad to hear that's still around. I remember on the website all those years ago, my manager showed me this. She said, look, it says, and the on the website was something like, look, you don't really want to play here, but you need to fill a Tuesday on your trip between Dallas and Las Vegas. So here we are. I'm like, yeah, that's true.
So I guess we can start there, because over the years, I mean, I saw you back in the day, you know, I think three or four times, and then I didn't see you at all. And over the years, I always wondered, I was like, what's Adam up to? So as quickly as you can, or as much detail as you want to go into, what have you been up to?
Well, I got pretty burnt out during the Bush administration. It was exhausting driving around the country. And you know, the life of a folk singer is really fun in your 20s, the salad days and the struggle. And then you watch your friends start to get nice stuff or whatever. So I got a little burnout, and I used to take a gig for three reasons. Either it paid a good amount of money, so that was worth it. Either or it was going to be fun, or it was going to help your career. And if it didn't have enough of any of those, why would you leave the house? And so I started, and then it became like helping my career. It's like, look, here's where I am. This is what I make. I'm not going to sit on Johnny Carson's couch like this, you know, like here's where I am. And so like that the young man's struggle for a career, you know, you leave that behind. And so then as gig offers sort of came in, I took less and less of them, because I was like, you know, the driving to Ohio to play a coffee house, and if I'm lucky, only lose $50 after gas. You know, plus, remember, when I was doing the 50-state tour, gas was $1.20 a gallon. And even then, it was 60% of my costs. So it all added up for me to, I guess, somewhat retire. I still wrote songs when I felt the calling. But at the time, I was sort of burnt out on, nobody wants to hear songs about me and my shitty relationships. Like, you know, what's like that? I've written hundreds of those and then at the time, I wasn't really like writing protest songs, just seemed really whiny. And, you know, now, obviously, it's different. Woody Guthrie's having yet another moment. And there's some people out here, myself included, trying to save democracy through song. And as I look around, we're not doing so great at that. But it doesn't mean we stop trying.
It's interesting because it's like you talking about, you know, going, man, you know, the coffers are a little bit emptier than I'd like. You got the memo early compared to a lot of people, because I think it took a lot of people a couple years beyond that to kind of, you know, say, yeah, it's got to make sense, man. Yeah.
Well, I had been doing it hard, you know, since like 97 or 98. I was doing 200, 250 days a year, you know, 250 dates. And so that'll get you the message, because that'll burn you out quicker. I was in Omaha. I was 35 years old and I was in Omaha, and I was hanging out with my friend Amy Ryan, who runs this. She owns a pizza shop that, and she has a real great art community connected to it, music and everything. And it was, and she was like, "Well, what do you want to do tonight?" It was the night after my show, and I had a day to hang out. What do you want to do tonight? And she was naming all the stuff, and then like casually she mentioned, "Or we could stay home and have game night." And the idea of staying home, like being in her house and playing games all night rather than going out to a club and dealing with that, like that sounded fun, and like. It should have set off more of a warning light. Like, dude, this is the beginning of the end. Be careful about sitting down because it's hard to get up again. But that I distinctly remember that that's when I had that basic change of like, you know, you don't have to go out every night. And that's how you get old.
Right. So at some point, you know, like you said, you didn't really stop writing. But at some point, there was enough energy, enticement to come back into the fold and make this album.
Yes, I thought I was, I thought I was retired. I thought that's fine. I'll play some songs. But now, you know, I'm trying to do my part to save America. And I looked, you know, I've been reading all this stuff about how to stop fascism. And I looked at an article, there's like six or seven different groups of people. And the only one in which I fully fit in was at the very bottom. And the movement needs artists and it needs to give people the energy. Years ago, I used to think, and this is what disheartened me, that if my job was as a folk singer, I would stand on a hill, I would stand on a stage and sing songs to a hill full of hippies who already agreed with me. And I was like, what is this doing? I'm not changing any minds. I'm not helping. You know, I'm just so. But then I came to shift and through doing a bunch of reading. And my job isn't to change people's minds, because the people that I meet that disagree with me, you're not going to change those minds. You know, the red hats, they're done. But what I can do is take all of these wonderful people that are in this together and give and enhance the sense of community. They come in exhausted from the fight, and I'm going to sing some songs, and they're going to be fun, and we're going to sing together, you know, that just like Pete Seeger said, and you're going to go out there tomorrow re-enthused, knowing that you're part of a community and you're not as alone as you thought, and this fight isn't futile. You're not just spitting in the ocean. All of us are going to make ripples, to mix a metaphor. And so I came to that, to the value of songs and of folk songs again. And I ended up, you know, sort of writing these songs. And then it took two people. It took Jesse Lundy, and it took Butch Ross. Butch is my old roommate, who's a musician, and Jesse is a promoter in town, and he also is in my band. And he basically said, well, let's just record these songs. And then he basically called me up and said, is Wednesday okay with you? I just booked some studio time. And I'm like, okay. So between that, and then Butch was passing through town 6 or 8 months ago. And can I crash at your place? Of course you can. So I get up, I walk Queequeg, and I come back, and there's microphones set up all over the living room. And he's like, have a cup of coffee, because we're finishing your album today. I'm like, what? And there's a song on the record called Don't Break Bread. And it's Don't Break Bread with Your Fascist Former Friends. And if it sounds a little rough, it's because he gave me 30 minutes to finish. I was like, this one isn't done yet, but I really want. He's like, okay, buddy, you have 30 minutes and then tape rolls. So it's a little rough, but we got it done. And so I really owe a debt, like a gratitude I'll never be able to repay to those guys, because they dragged this across the finish line in a way that that I may not have. You know, I'm okay at writing songs, and then the rest of the job is problematic for me.
Right. Yeah. So having those songs to sing and creating community and things like that, that is huge, right? Because I was at a show last week and this band played both you know, This Land Is Your Land and For What It's Worth. And I thought, man, this is really a service because this is giving us some sense of relief in the moment.
Yes. Yes. Like I said, Pete used to say it all the time. The power of a bunch of people singing together is, you know, and at the end of his life, he admitted, he's like, I can't even really sing anymore, but I can stand up here with the banjo and lead people. And it turns out that that is very, very important. And it makes people, you know, a sense of community is one of the most important things in this struggle.
Now, this record wouldn't be a record from you if there weren't that infusion of humor.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as funny as I would typically be in I feel like my other records are funnier because I was younger and more insouciant about just putting anything down if it was funny. So yeah, so I like to think this record will make you laugh, but I got serious things to say too.
Yeah, I mean, I think back about something like On Civil Rights. That was one of the first tunes that I heard from you. And I was like, oh, there's that. This is serious, but there's that. Yeah.
Yes. It's, you know, a spoonful of sugar in the medicine and whatnot. It, I actually, one of my life, if not my life's mission, people say comedy equals tragedy plus time. I disagree with that. I think comedy equals tragedy plus 18 inches. If it doesn't happen in your personal space, it can be funny. And it's kind of my goal to prove to show you that things can be horrible at the very same time that they're hysterical. The story I always use to validate this is in 1998, long story, Howard, my good friend Howard and his wife Jen and me and my girlfriend at the time, TJ, drove up to New York so I could play a show in the East Village. And the four of us drove up together and the three of us drove home because TJ decided to make out with some dude in the back of the club while I was playing my set. And that was heartbreaking to me. And I came home alone. I couldn't find her and I had to leave New York. So Howard, my good friend, is busting my chops all the way home. And his wife's like, Howard, don't do that. Don't do that. It's not funny. And I'm like, no, Howard, keep doing it because it's horrible. It's sad, but it's also hilarious that this happened, that I'm playing my songs and she's making out with some dude. Like, that's funny. So that is my goal, is that just because something is terrible doesn't mean it isn't funny also.
Yeah. I mean, see also Mel Brooks.
Precisely. Yes. I was thinking the other day, I mean, if the guy who ends up cleaning out Mel Brooks' house doesn't know, he's just going to be like, there are a lot of Hitler outfits in this house. There is a ton of swastikas in this house. This is interesting. But yes, Mel is obviously one, you know, he should be everyone's idol, but he's certainly one of mine. Yes.
Yeah.
I was 12 or 13 when History of the World came out. And so, I mean, that's right in a 12-year-old's wheelhouse.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Well, now, of course, this is something too, that I think is important to point out, is that, you know, some people might listen to this music and they go, oh, you know, leftist hippie and stuff, but you're not above, poking at liberals.
Yes. Liberals can be very, I mean, like, you know, with the purity tests and, the Israel and yes, they are annoying as well. And I like to be equal opportunity. Although we are well beyond both sides-ing because, you know, one side is a little bit annoying and the other side are effing fascists who want to end American democracy and kill a lot of my friends. So, you know, it's both sides-ing doesn't work anymore, but yes, liberals can be annoying.
Yeah. I think Phil Oakes was kind of a touchstone singer for you, wasn't he?
Yes, yes, yes. Obviously, a small circle of friends. That's probably the song you're referring to.
Yeah.
Yeah, about how annoying liberals are. Yes, I do very much enjoy a lot of Phil Oakes. I'm not a fan of his love songs because that's not my wheelhouse. That's not my thing. I mean, he's very good at it. Pleasures of the Harbor and whatnot. But there are, I really like about half of Phil Oakes songs.
Yeah. Well, let's talk too about 2020, the song. So I can imagine that if you had still at that point been out doing even just 100 shows a year, 2020 would have been really weird for you. But you had set that all behind by this point. So unlike a lot of musicians, you had a different experience.
I tell you what, man. Yes, I had a different experience. I was very fortunate in that I like had a not a very good one, but a regular job at the time. So I was able to get the $1,400 the government gave us all or whatever. Because if I didn't, I would have been, you know, a little more of an off the grid guy and may not have qualified. But yeah, so I staying home and communicating with people over a distance was weird, but it was what I was doing anyway. And I actually ended up in 2020 with maybe more shows than I would have had, because I did a few Zoom shows. I think Americana Highways was one of them. They had me log on and do a half an hour bit set, and But yeah, 2020 was rough. But I mean, I'm kind of an introvert. Like, it doesn't seem like it because I talk real loud and make jokes. But people, you know, I'm a little iffy on them. So hanging out for a year and a half inside my house with just my dog was not the worst thing in the world. I'm like, my married friends would call me to make sure I was doing okay. I was like, I'm doing great. I'm okay. Like, I got Netflix. I'm okay.
I think we introverts did okay in that.
Yes.
By and large. Now, you also wrote Birthday Cake, which I love for a lot of reasons, but just this, was this for your mom or was this for a friend?
My sister.
Your sister.
Yeah. And that's really weird because I wrote it originally as just a poem for her birthday. I always post something on her Facebook page and I thought this is just for me and her or whatever. But then I realized that the only reason it really wasn't a song was because when I wrote it, the guitar was way over there and I feel like standing up. And then I put, you know, a D and an A minor and under it. And all of a sudden now it's a song. It's not a song that I expected. It wasn't for anybody. It was for her and it was for me. And the fact that everybody, including my promoter, Adam Dawson from Broken Jukebox, he's like, this has to be the single. I'm like, this has to be the single. I mean, it's kind of slow and dirgy and it's about a dead sister. Like, this is the single. He's like, trust me. I'm like, okay, you're the guy, you know. So it's the second single, and it took me by surprise, A, that people liked it, because I wrote it very specifically. I wasn't writing for an audience. I was writing to, you know, get stuff out. And I have never sung it in public live. I mean, I haven't planned that many shows, but I'm going to have to, and because I don't always get through it without crying, which is not the particular, I mean, I guess, chicks can dig that when you're on stage or whatever, but I don't really want to cry on stage. That's not really what I want to bring to the show. So I'm trying to, we'll see. I got a bunch of shows coming up in the next few months. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things that, it's specific, but then it generalizes in such a way that we can attach to it, you know, cause I was at a house show Saturday night and the performer, you know, I mean, it was sad because there were like three people from the last time he played Wichita who weren't there, you know, and and it was like, I just start thinking about like, yeah, man, what would those guys have, you know, brought to this show or thought about this or, you know, so we do that. And that's, I think, why that song works especially well.
Yeah, I'm. Thank you for listening to it. I'm still stunned that people are digging it and people write to me, oh, you made me cry in my car on the way to work, and I'm really a little bit stunned because it's great that it's for other people, but I did not write it with that goal. I just wrote it to, you know, try and get some peace with my sister.
Yeah, wow. Well, thank you for sharing it with us.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's a real gift. Thank you. I also want to talk about King of Anti-Folk for a number of reasons, not least of which is that you give Wichita a shout out in it. But this is kind of a chronicle of a period in your life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, like when you're young, everybody's doing it. And then people, like it says in the song, people, you know, they start having kids, they go to grad school, you know, like one day you wake up. Everybody has that. Lots of people have that moment when your 20s end, when you wake up and you look at the person in the bed next to you whose name you think you remember or like whatever, and just be like, oh man, I gotta go to grad school. I gotta get a job. And you realize, okay, it's time. And then a few of us who just cling on to the music, we keep doing it, and you watch the other names drop, and then you become old and venerated. And these, you know, these kids say things, they're like, oh my God, you drove to Wichita and played a show. That's so romantic. I was like, you weren't there, dude. They have that. I hope they still have it. Kirby's that circling smoke filter that has been there since 1972 and hasn't worked in 73. I love that thing. other thing that I remember, one of my favorite things, I used to tell it on stage, was two guys came to the show. Two guys, each of them had a prosthetic, it wasn't a hook, but they had a prosthetic arm. And I asked, did you guys meet at like at rehab or something? He's like, no. His arm, he got his arm stuck in the thresher, and I went in after it. I was like, that is a good friend. That is a good friend. Like, when they clapped, they had to do it as a team.
Wow. Yeah. So now that you're, you know, you've got the record coming out, you're doing some shows. There are those places where, you know, you toured over the years and you built up audience and so forth. Are you thinking like this is a chance to reconnect with some of them, or do you just kind of assume like, you know, they might not remember me?
It's not that they won't remember me. It's just that they're sitting on their couch with their 9-year-olds and, you know, and their aging parents that they got to take care of. And they're getting school. Like, these people don't have time. My Gen Xers, man. And not only that, you know, they've got 700 channels on their 65-inch TV. It's hard. And all their food is right there. And their bladders, which don't hold for as long as they used to, they can stop and go whiz. It's hard to get people out of the house. I know, because I'm people, and it's hard to get me out of the house. So honestly, I love to play shows. I would love to play shows. But the way these things are, I'm doing some East Coast runs and stuff like that. I don't have any particular plans to come. Like, I'm sure I could have a lovely show in Wichita somewhere, maybe at Kirby's, you know, where 35 people might come out. We'd have a good time, and I'd walk with a couple of $100s. But I can't string a whole tour together like that. It's financially unfeasible. So unfortunately, a place like Wichita, where, you know, no one's going to fly me in and give me a guarantee, because I'm not worth it. And I can't really drive there. Unfortunately, you're going to have to download these songs and listen to them that way, and maybe I'll make some videos. But it's possible. I want to do the East Coast, and it is possible. I used to have enough fans. Like, I could fly to the West Coast and do a bunch of California and Oregon and Washington to make it worth my while. Maybe, maybe not. We'll see. So, like, and I've told this to my promoter, like, we're doing different things with this record. We would love to get it on playlists. I just want people to listen to the music. Like, you know, basically, I almost didn't get CDs printed. And he's like, no, you got to get CDs printed. First of all, he said, I need some to hand out, and your fans are going to want to buy them. I'm like, but who listens to CDs? Like, they're going to want to buy them. He's like, don't give your fans a chance not to give you $20. I'm like, well, if you say so. So I'm selling these records, but, you know, the record comes out June 5th, and they're all going to be free everywhere, all the songs. So I want people to listen to them, because I'm pretty proud of them. I've been, you know, when you make a record, you listen to the songs so much that by the time the record comes out, you absolutely hate not only those songs, but all your songs, your face, your existence. You know, you've been so much in up your own butt for so long. But I've been listening to these songs in my car, partially to learn them for the shows. And I'm like, hey, Adam, you made a pretty good record. So I'm pretty pleased with the way it sounds, and I'm excited to share them with people because it shows. I you know, how could it not? This is my first record in over 20 years, so it should show growth. But it also, I feel, has enough of the old school. Like, if you liked it before, like The King of Antifolk, you know, like the record was vaguely going to be titled The King of Antifolk until it became a record expressly about trying to stop fascism. So, it's, you know, but that's a straightforward up the middle Adam Brodsky song. Like, in terms of anti-folk, Lenny Molotov once said, you know, there's various pieces of anti-folk under the umbrella, and he called me, you're like the Bronco Nagurski of anti-folk, just right up the middle. I'm like, yeah, I'll take that. So
I think there's a cool thing about this too in what you're doing, because this is also some kid who's learning three chords might see you or hear this record, and they're like, I can do that, and I can do my part, you know?
I mean, this is the best thing about folk music, is that, you know, the people can play it. And you know, anti-folk, an oversimplification of the definition of anti-folk, is basically the intersection between DIY, the DIY aspects of folk music, and the DIY aspects of old school punk rock, like the Ramones. And anti-folk finds a very natural cradle in there. And I love that. I think it's very, very important that that folk music is music of the people, and there should be, you should be writing songs for your own community, in your own community, for bigger needs. And like, you know, if we all do this and we don't get fatigued, you know, Ani DeFranco, I heard this in Ani DeFranco show. She showed us like, as long as we all don't take a breath at the same time, we can sing forever. And that's, you know, I'm a cog in the wheel, a piece in the puzzle, whatever metaphor you want to metaphorize with.
I don't know, hoagie on the table. I don't know what.
I am an onion in the hoagie of life, or whatever.
I'm a large Wawa mug. I don't know.
I hate to admit it because I love Philadelphia more than anything. But man, now they're letting the Wawa family is letting Wawas go here. The food's no good. The service is no. It's unfortunately, it's not the place it used to be, and it's so hard. In Pennsylvania, you have the Wawa versus Sheetz debate. You know, somewhere around Harrisburg, it switches. And I used to be a hardcore Wawa, and I'd fight for that, John. But it's tough to make a case these days. The Wawa has fallen. I know. It is sad.
I got to pour out a Yingling for them or something.
You know what's up.
You've been listening to a conversation with Adam Bronski. His new album, American Epitaph, is out June 5th. You can learn more about him at adambronski.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time, and as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson.